Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, May 25th. MISD student returns home after assault. Assault sent Alamo Junior High student to Lubbock ICU. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. After nearly a week, Belinda Mendoza finally brought her daughter home from the hospital Sunday. Mendoza's eighth-grade daughter was hospitalized on May 15th and then transported to Lubbock's Covenant Hospital, where she spent part of 3 days in the ICU, the result of an assault at Alamo Junior High School. Mendoza told the Reporter Telegram on Wednesday that her daughter's school year is effectively over, but the waiting continues. First, there is the wait that continues with the healing. Her daughter, who isn't named in the story, still feels the pain associated with a hematoma on her pancreas. The industry caused internal bleeding and then so much pain that her daughter could not walk by herself for 5 days. Second, the wait continues to see if the person who is on video assaulting her daughter will be punished. The family claims they have not heard of an arrest and that the other girl will be able to return to school next year when both will be in the ninth grade at Legacy Freshman High School. Mendoza said that Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard told Mendoza this week that her daughter will be able to transfer to another school if she chooses, but there's nothing that the district can do to prevent her attacker from being on the Legacy Freshman campus. Quote, "I have to pull my daughter out of MISD to protect my daughter from her," Mendoza said. "I don't feel safe having her daughter attending any schools. That girl will be in MISD, and that isn't fair," end quote. The following is the district's comment on the situation. Quote, "Midland ISD police are currently investigating an assault that occurred between two female students at Alamo Junior High last week. One student was taken to the hospital due to her injuries. The suspected aggressor in the incident is being disciplined according to the student code of conduct. The investigation into the incident is ongoing. MISD wishes the student who was injured a full and speedy recovery," end quote. A student is beat down. Mendoza said her daughter was walking in an outside hallway when the attacker, a larger girl, one that her daughter claimed to not know well, came up to her from behind, and the assailant grabbed her and began hitting her. There wasn't much her daughter could do to defend herself once the attacker got her on the ground and continued to beat her. Her daughter could not be seen on the school camera. The other girl completely covered her, Mendoza said. The students in the hall all gathered around and started filming the assault. No one helped her," end quote. Staff arrived, broke up the assault, and the students were sent to a vice principal's office. Mendoza's daughter claimed to not feeling good and that her stomach hurt. An initial examination by the school nurse didn't indicate any injuries, the family said. Quote, "The whole time I was never notified by the school," Mendoza said. "Her daughter called me to pick her up from school," end quote. Mendoza said that when she arrived at Alamo Junior High, the school principal said that the fight was mutual and that both students were talking trash leading up to the assault. Mendoza said once Midland ISD police looked at the recording around an hour later, they said it was an assault, that the other girl should be arrested. Mendoza said not long after MISD police and the principal were called out to another fight on campus. Mendoza's daughter then started to throw up and complain about her stomach. A police officer told the mother she needs to take her daughter to the hospital, Mendoza said. not at MMH Long. By the time the family reached the emergency room, Mendoza's daughter couldn't walk because of the pain. A doctor gave her medicine for the pain, but there was no improvement. Finally, a scan showed what is happening internally, Mendoza said. The Alamo Junior High student is transported to Lubbock via an ambulance. She arrives around between 2 and 3 a.m. on May 16th. Mendoza said the goal was that recovery happen without surgery. Still, Mendoza's daughter is kept in the ICU until May 18th. At that time, the hospital officials move her onto another floor. She was still in pain. Finally, on Sunday, she can walk by herself, allowing for a discharge to take place. Mendoza said the Alamo principal has called regularly for updates. During this week, the family started a GoFundMe page to help with expenses, and Mendoza's sister provided updates, including one on May 17th, quote, "Anything will help the family at this time. Thank you again to everyone who has kept Mendoza's daughter in your prayers." Prayers work. Mendoza's 14-year-old daughter told the reported telegram she thought she was going to die in the hospital because of the pain. She also said, "She is thankful for people praying for me, because if not for them, I am not sure I would have felt better," end quote. Mendoza's daughter said she wants her attacker punished for what she did. Quote, "I was in the hospital for a week," she said. "What I went through is more than she will go through," end quote. Mendoza told the reported telegram the school district will not provide a copy of its video of the incident. She stated that the family is considering its legal options against the other student, her family, and the district. "For now, though, everyone is home. There are summer weeks to determine what to do about where Mendoza's daughter will go to school next year, and time to think about the system they claim affords her attacker more rights than her daughter." Midland mailbox thefts shine light on big issue. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Brian Sales of the Sales Team Realtors didn't expect a call from a check cashing business located inside a Kentwick location, but the call left him feeling violated nevertheless. An employee called to let him know that someone had attempted to cash a Sales Team business check. As it turned out, the name of the payee was changed and a different signature added. The manager thought the check looked suspicious, called sales, and alerted him of a bigger problem. Someone was stealing mail from his business mailbox. Sales said the theft wasn't limited to the mailbox of the Sales Team Realtors, but others along Tradewinds Boulevard near the Scarper Sports Complex. The call also led to changes in the sales team's incoming and outgoing mail. First, a high-security mailbox has been ordered. Second, outgoing mail is hand-delivered to a Postal Service employee or placed in a USPS collection box. Third, incoming mail for the time being is brought directly into the business. Others along Tradewinds have invested in securing their respective mailboxes and installing cameras to catch future mailbox thieves in the act. Sales told the reported telegram the break-in led to conversations with the Midland police, who said there wasn't much they can do, and with the United States Postal Inspection Service, the investigatory wing of the USPS. As it turned out, Sales is not alone with issues of mail theft. Earlier this month, Reuters reported the USPS is taking steps to crack down on rising mail theft, robberies of carriers, change of address fraud, and counterfeit postage. The article stated that USPS reported more than 25,000 thefts from mail receptacles, including blue collection boxes, in the 6 months ending March 30th, compared with 38,500 for all of 2022. Some of its protections, according to Reuters, include the installation of 12,000 high-security blue collection boxes nationwide to make access more difficult for criminals, the evaluation of replacing additional existing blue collection boxes, replacing 49,000 antiquated aero locks with electronic locks to address an increase in letter carrier robberies nationwide. The article also stated criminals are targeting letter carriers for their keys to steal mail from secure mail receptacles and commit financial fraud crimes. The problem of mail theft has the attention of lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Last week, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas, and U.S. Representative Randy Weber, a Republican from Texas, introduced the Upholding a Secure Postal Service, or USPS Act, which would require the Comptroller General of the United States, who leads the Government Accountability Office, the investigative office for Congress, to submit a report to Congress on nationwide mail theft trends and postal property to the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability and to the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. This report, required each year for 5 years, would also include details on measures the Postal Service has taken to combat theft. For the sales team realtors, the theft could have ended differently. If not for the call from the Kentwick location, a thief would have walked away with sales team money and a vendor would have been unpaid. Also, the office would have remained unaware of a potential problem and remained a target for future break-ins, including at a time when other mail with even greater value could have been there for the taking. Sales told the reported Telegram of the issue to bring awareness to an issue that mail theft can impact anyone and that those involved are sophisticated in their practices. He stated the check that someone attempted to cash had a name of someone else in the sales team office, which showed the homework done to get away with a crime. The criminals removed information, including the signature, without affecting pre-printed portion of the check. Quote, "There is a feeling of being violated," Sales said. "Realtors are fiduciaries, so we have a high degree of financial fiduciary responsibility to our clients, and if my mailbox is not secure, then am I performing up to the level I should as a broker? So just that little feeling like their mail to me is not safe, that's an issue," end quote. The perfect patient is more than a care package service. The story was written by Morgan Taylor Thomas. The perfect prologue. When Janie, daughter of close friend Jessica Pierce, received a brain tumor diagnosis, Beth Harris started thinking of what to send to show her love and support. Yet, instead of flowers or balloons or a card, Harris turned toward her experience as a children's speech-language pathologist. With the help of fellow Midlander Jennifer Yeager, Harris created a goodie bag filled with hands-on activities meant to help time pass positively for both Janie and the rest of the Pierce family. The next day, Harris founded The Perfect Patient, a care package company focused on providing intentional and interactive items backed by joy for children and families experiencing hospital stays or medical events. Not only passionate about the project, but a first-hand witness of the business's impact, Pierce joined her friend's partnership. The trio added Abby Christensen to seal the deal, and a dream team came to fruition. TPP launched on March 23rd and has been making moves since then. The Perfect Pack. Two already made bags, the Janie and the John, both named after children undergoing treatment, provide the basis, but what exactly comes in a perfect patient care package and how does it benefit everyone involved? Based on their own personal and professional experiences, the 4-woman crew came up with the following. Notepad and pen. For parents, being in the hospital and not having something to write on is very stressful, Harris explained. You always need to write notes or questions for the doctor. Response card. When you're in the hospital and you receive gifts, it's like, okay, I want to send you a thank you note, but out of sight, out of mind. So, every package has a stamped card that can also just be sent to a friend to say, this is how I'm feeling, Harris said. Miniature coloring roll, card games, memory games, puzzles, and more. A lot of these things serve as really great distractions while parents are talking to a nurse or doctor, and it's also something a child life specialist could say, hey, it's okay, you're getting an IV, and then can pull something out to distract them. Everything is really used to facilitate fine motor skills and language, because you can play with parents, siblings, friends who visit, or even by yourself. Add-on options include a Lego set called the Perfect Pack of Potential, a jewelry-making bead kit, a very cozy sweatshirt blanket, a TPP ball cap, and a matching set of bracelets, collaboration with Happy Magnolias. All items can be ordered at theperfectpatient.com. The Perfect Patient. Although Harris and her crew market toward kids dealing with health problems, the entrepreneur said their kits have been sent to an array of recipients. Quote, they've been sent to a couple of 60-year-old men recovering from accidents. My mom is in a nursing home, and she received a blanket. They've been sent to children grieving the loss of a loved one. And they've also been sent in celebration, like being cancer-free. Harris said, quote, while it seems like it should be a kid bag, everything in there is engaging and entertaining and a nice alternative to flowers and candy, end quote. Since the company's online opening, they've worked with hospitals throughout the state, created partnerships, and are continuing to change lives. As for the future, the squad has started creating a tween-teen-focused bag, an adult bag, and more. Don't know who to send a package to? No worries. Click on A Kit to a Kid on the TPP website, and the group will handle it for you. TheperfectPatient.com. The Perfect People. If you aren't convinced already that The Perfect Patient is a business you absolutely should support, then let me give you 4 more reasons. Beth, Abby, Jennifer, and Jessica. For this team, TPP is not about the money or how aesthetically pleasing they can create a gift bag. For this team, the true purpose and passion comes from helping those in need, especially children. With all 4 women carrying the title of mom, Beth, Abby, Jennifer, and Jessica know what it takes to make a functional world go round. But when you add a hospital stay into the mix, life gets turned upside down. If they can help ease that stress for just one fellow mom, parent, guardian, or caretaker, they'll never quit. Working out of the 4 homes, Beth and Abby in Midland, Jessica and Jennifer in Dallas, the group packs mails for next day delivery, markets, develops, creates, and succeeds. These exceptional women do it all, and without their beaming bright lights, the world would be a slightly darker place. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, May 25th. Michael Barry Trost was born in St. Paul, Minnesota on August 24, 1938, and after various and assorted stops, completed that journey on Thursday, May 18, 2023, in Midland, Texas. Michael was a devoted and civic-minded person. He loved all things Midland and believed in the value of the community. Michael cherished his time serving 3 terms as a member of the Midland City Council. He loved all things concerning theater and delighted in sharing his talents on the stage of both MCT and the Yucca Theater. Michael loved family life. When Michael and I married eons ago, I, Leanna, brought 4 children to the marriage, Ken, Heather, Amber, and Brandy. We rounded out that family with the apple of his eye, Chandler Roland Trost. Added twinkles included 3 handsome grandsons and 2 beautiful granddaughters. Michael is survived by 1 sister and a host of nieces and nephews and other relatives. There will be no service at this time. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Donald Lloyd Reimer, age 76, of Odessa, passed away on May 21st at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home, Crematory of Midland.
Odessa American Readings, read by Julie. Tina Turner, unstoppable superstar, whose hits include What's Love Got to Do with It, Dead at 83. By Haley Itali. New York. Tina Turner, the unstoppable singer and stage performer who teamed with husband Ike Turner for a dynamic run of hit records and live shows in the 1960s and 70s, and survived her horrifying marriage to triumph in middle age with chart topper What's Love Got to Do with It, has died at 83. Turner died Tuesday after a long illness in her home in Küsnacht near Zurich, Switzerland, according to her manager. She became a Swiss citizen a decade ago. Few stars traveled so far. She was born Anna Mae Bullock in a segregated Tennessee hospital and spent her later years on a 22,600-square-foot estate at Lake Zurich, and overcame so much, physically battered, emotionally devastated, and financially ruined by her 20-year relationship with Turner. She became a superstar on her own in her 40s, at a time when most of her peers were on their way down, and remained on top as concert draw for years after. With admirers ranging from Beyoncé to Mick Jagger, Turner was one of the world's most successful entertainers. Known for a core of pop, rock, and rhythm and blues favorites, Proud Mary, Nutbush City Limits, River Deep, Mountain High, and the hits she had in the 80s among them, What's Love Got to Do with It, We Don't Need Another Hero, and the cover of Al Green's Let's Stay Together. Her trademarks were her glowing contralto, her bold, small, strong cheekbones, her palette of wigs, and a muscular, quick-stepping leg she did not shy from showing off. She sold more than 150 million records worldwide, won 12 Grammys, was voted along into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991, and on her own in 2021 was honored at the Kennedy Center in 2005, with Beyoncé and Oprah Winfrey among those praising her. Her life became the basis for a film, a Broadway musical, and an HBO documentary in 2021 that she called her public farewell. Until she left her husband and revealed that their backstory, she was known as a vicarious onstage foil of a steady going like the leading lady of Ike and Tina Turner Revue. Ike was billed first and ran the show, choosing the material, the arrangements, the backing singers. They toured constantly for years, in part because Ike was often short of money and unwilling to miss a concert. Tina Turner was forced to go on with bronchitis, pneumonia, with a collapsed right lung. Other times, the cause of her misfortunes was Ike himself. As she recounted in the memoir, Ike began hitting her not long after they met in the 1950s and only grow more vicious, provoked by anything and anyone. He would throw hot chalk coffee in her face, choke her or beat her until her eyes were swollen shut, then rape her. Before one show, he broke her jaw and she went on stage with a mouthful of blood. Terrified both of being with Ike and being without him, she credited her emerging Buddhist faith in the mid-70s with giving her a sense of strength and sudden worth, and she finally left in early July 1976. The Ike and Turner Review was scheduled to open a tour making the country's bicentennial when Tina snuck out of the Dallas hotel room with just a mobile credit card and 36 cents while Ike slept. She hurried across a nearby highway, narrowing avoiding a speeding truck, and found another hotel to stay. I looked at him, Ike, and thought, "You just meet me for the last time, you sucker," she recalled in her memoir. Tina was among the first to celebrate, to speak candidly about domestic abuse, being a heroin-battered woman with a symbol of resilience to all. Ike Turner did not deny mistreating her, although he tried to blame Tina for their troubles. When he died in 2007, a representative for his ex-wife said simply, "Tina is aware that Ike passed away." Little of this was apparent to many Ike and Tina fans. The Turners were a hot act for much of the 60s and into their 70s, evolving from bluesy ballads such as "A Fool in Love" and "It's Going to Work Out Fine" to flashy covers of "Proud Mary" and "Come Together" and other rock stars that brought them across and crossed much success. They opened for the Rolling Stones in 1966 and 1969 and were seen performing a lustful version of Otis Redding's "I've Been Loving You Too Long" in the 70s Stone documentary, Gimme Shelter. Lawrence Fishburne and Angela Bassett gave Oscar-nominated performances as Ike and Tina in the 1993 movie, What's Love Got to Do with It, based on I, Tina. But she would say that reliving her years with Ike was so painful she couldn't bring herself to watch the movie. Ike and Tina reworking A Proud Mary, originally a tight, mid-tempo hit for Creedence Clearwater Revival, helped define their assertive sexual image. Against a background of funky guitar and Ike's grooming baritone, Tina began with a few spoken words about how some people wanted to hear songs that were nice and easy. "But there's one thing," she warned, "you see, we never do anything nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough." But by the end of the 1970s, Turner's career seemed to be finished. She was in her 40s, her first solo album had flopped, and her live shows were mostly confined to the cabaret circuit. Desperate for work and money, she even gained a tour in South Africa when the country was wildly boycotted because of its racist anti-apartheid regime. Rock stars helped her back. Rod Stewart convinced her to sing "Hot Legs" with him on Saturday Night Live, and Jagger, who had openly borrowed some of Turner on the stage moves, sang "Honky Tonk Women" with her during the Stones' 1981-1982 tour. At a listening party in 1983 album, Let's Dance, David Bowie told guests that Tina was her favorite female singer. More popular in England at the time than in the U.S., she recorded a Rhapsody version of Let's Stay Together and EMI's at Abbey Road Studios in London. By the end of 1983, Let's Stay Together was a hit throughout Europe and on the verge of breaking in the States. An A&R man at Capitol Records, John Carter, urged the label to sign her and make an album. Among the material presented to her was a reflective pop reggae ballad co-written by Terry Britton and Graham Lyle, initially dismissed by Tina as whimsy. "I just thought it was some old pop song, and I didn't like it," she later said of What's Got to Do with It. Turner's Private Dancer album came out in May 1984, sold more than 8 million copies, and featured several hit singles, including the title song and Better Be Good to Me. It won 4 Grammys, among them Record of the Year for What's Love Got to Do with It, the song that came to define the clear-eyed image of her post-Ike years. "People look at me now and think a hot life I must have lived. Ha," she wrote in her memoir. Bowie student captures prestigious art honor. A painting of a partial skeleton with heart showing through has earned a Bowie Middle School student a platinum award from the Visual Arts Scholastic event. Although she painted as a hobby when she was younger, 13-year-old 8th grader Danielle Gomez had devoted more of her attention to sports in recent years. She was in volleyball and basketball and wanted to add track, but found out she had a heart condition. Being able to participate in sports this year, she started going to art clubs at Bowie for something to do. Gomez was recently cleared to play again, but in wearing a heart monitor to figure out why she was having issues. The winning painting was inspired by what she was going through at the time. "I lost motivation to finish it, and then I came back and finished it," Gomez said. Her art teacher, Whitney Clark, said Gomez worked on the painting for well over 2 months. The painting is done in acrylic. She likes acrylic and how it works. The process calms her down, helps her forget about everything and express what she's going through without talking. Her medium depends on what she feels like doing, but Clark said she's used to just about everything, including coffee. She added that Gomez is an excellent, trustworthy student. I gave her this canvas just as something to do. It wasn't for a project. It wasn't for competition. I just handed her a canvas and said, just paint, Clark said, so she was able to express herself. Clark talked Gomez into entering the painting in vase. I told her she would do really well, but I don't think she was sure of it. She was very nervous, Clark said. She scored a 4, which is the highest ranking she could get. After her interview with the judge, she left before the judge for platinum, which is equivalent to state competition, but it's our version of state for middle school. Gomez says she thought Clark was lying when she told her she'd won the award. She was sleeping on her way up to her heart appointment in Lubbock when Clark called. Her dad woke Gomez up to talk to Clark, and Clark told her about the award. Gomez wasn't convinced until she got the medal. At first, Gomez helped Clark with art club after school. One day, she didn't have anything to do, so Clark handed her a canvas to paint. Gomez said painting came back to her a little bit at a time. I'm mostly focused on sports, so I didn't really have time for paintings or anything, she added. But Clark said Gomez has a lot of natural artistic talent, noted that Gomez has to take at least one more year of art in high school. Gomez will be going to Odessa High School next fall. Clark added that she knows all of Gomez's art teachers, so she will be keeping an eye out when she moves on to OHS. In my opinion, she's very shy. She doesn't like to talk to a lot of people. I think with her artwork, what I've seen from her over this year is her way to express herself. She draws about her family and herself, but she doesn't talk much about it, Clark said. Gomez has an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister. Her family was proud of her accomplishments. She didn't want to do the interview or have the award. I called her mom and got her mom's permission because she was very reserved, very quiet, Clark said. Bowie principal Amy Russell said she's been working with students this year to help them see their future and not just what there is here and now. She said Gomez was able to think about her options outside of sports and see what else was available to her. Thank goodness for our art teachers here, our special area teachers. They can provide an opportunity for kids to find a home, find a community in another part of education. I'm so proud of Miss Carter for making it happen for Gomez, Russell said. Parker McCollum set to perform at La Hacienda. La Hacienda Event Center, 12600 Highway 191, Midland, has scheduled Parker McCollum with special guest Larry Fleet at 7:30 p.m. June 9th. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit tinyurl.com/2BV5AMZ8. Tickets start at $55. Texas Pose to fund community college based on student outcomes. By Kate McGee. Bipartisan legislation that would overhaul how Texas funds its community college is heading to Governor Greg Abbott's desk for approval after the House agreed to accept the Senate's amendment Wednesday. Last week, the Senate unanimously approved a House bill to fund the state's community college based on how many of their students graduate with a degree or certificate or transfer to a 4-year university. Currently, schools are largely funded based on the number of hours students spend in the classroom. Bill sponsor, Republican Gary Van Dever, Republican New Boston, has previously told the Texas Tribune the House was likely to accept the Senate additions. Van Dever served as a commission on lawmakers and community college presidents last year and recommended the changes, along with a long list of ways the state could better support the more than 642,000 students who attend Texas's 50 community college districts. The Senate added language from 7 smaller high education bills to the legislature, nearly all of which have already passed out of one or both chambers. These include legislation to provide new grant funds for students and workforce development, legislation to ease the student transfer process between 2- and 4-year schools, and one billing deals with student privacy. In a press release, a coalition of business and higher education advocates celebrated the bill's passage. By 2030, 62% of all Texas jobs will require post-secondary credentials. But Texas businesses are already struggling to find qualified workers, Justin Yancey, Texas Business Leadership Council president, said in a statement. Now, thanks to the passage of House Bill 8, state leader can continue to address the skilled workforce shortage, support our businesses, and ensure more Texans can earn self-sustaining wages. A new budget provision that is contingent on the legislation passing shows that in the next 2 years, the new funding model would direct about $2.2 billion towards public community colleges, compared with the old system, which would have provided $1.8 billion. Texas community colleges are primarily funded by local property taxes, student tuition, and fees, and state money. While every community college receives a little over $1.3 million for core operations to each two-year budget, the rest of the money it receives from the state is allocated in two ways. The vast majority of that funding depends on how many hours of instruction students receive, called contact hours. The rest, around 10%, is awarded based on milestones like the number of students who complete their first year of math, earn 15 credit hours, or graduate with an associate's degree. But over time, the state's share has not kept pace with the source of funding and now accounts for less than 25% of community college budget. School leaders say the state needs to rethink how community colleges respond to workforce demands and prioritize efforts to enroll more student programs for industries and pay well, but don't take a long time to complete. House Bill 8 would shift the funding balance so most of the money that schools get from the state is based on the student outcomes. Students would compete for funding against their own progress in those areas. Specifically, the legislation says the state would allocate funding to colleges based on metrics like the number of credentials they award in high-demand industries, the number of students who earn 15 hours and then transfer to four-year university, or the number of high school students who earn at least 15 credits through a dual-credit program. Instead of waiting for lawmakers to allocate a pot of funding each session, schools would be able to look at their data and determine what their funding levels would be. The new finance system will fundamentally shift how community colleges support their students ultimately, providing them with more valuable options as workforce programs receive as much of the emphasis as academic programs, said Renzo Soto, a policy advisor for Texas 2036, a nonprofit focused on improving Texas' future through public policy. This all accumulates into a greater focus on ensuring community colleges are delivering workforce returns for students, employers, and their state funding tied to the student outcomes that matter most. Earning a credential of value that prepares them for the workforce. House Bill 8 lays out a roadmap for the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board to implement the new funding system. But it will require the state agency to determine many specifics, such as new formulas to calculate just how much money each college would receive. As the bill is written now, the state agency would have until September 1st to put the new system in place. Texas Higher Education Commission Harrison Keller said that means the board would need to have the details decided by mid-July to get state approval. Keller called the legislation historic and said it was crucial that all community college leaders across the state back the change. We could not complete making such a dramatic change so quickly without the strong partnership and buy-in from community college leaders across the state, he said. Tony says, why is COBRA only paying 20% of my Medicare claim? By Tony King. Tony, I need your Medicare guidance because in December, I was rushed to the ER because of kidney failure caused from stage 4 of prostate cancer, which has spread to my pelvic bones. Because I was working full-time, I took a leave of absence with the short-term disability in January for 60 days while receiving my cancer treatment, which ended on February 28th. I was informed while in the hospital for cancer treatment that I had qualified for long-term disability and would no longer be part of the company's health plan since I was not a full-time employee. COBRA would begin immediately. I enrolled and paid for COBRA to attend the medical care, which I am having cancer treatment. It took 6 weeks to get the paperwork to Social Security for Medicare Part B to begin May 1st, which is since I am not working full-time. Now my COBRA nightmare begins. COBRA is only paying 20% of medical bills, and I was billed at 80% because I was not enrolled in Medicare Part B, which had totaled over $40,000. Please help me solve it. COBRA financial nightmare. Thanks, Robert, Tomball, Texas. Hello, Robert. Those reading this article need to realize the seriousness of Medicare and insurance rules. The Medicare and You Handbook discusses topics such as special enrollment periods and should I get Part B. It states that COBRA is not considered coverage based on current employee benefits. You have 8 months to sign up for Medicare Part B without a penalty if you are not working full-time or have lost your company benefits, whichever comes first. The eighth-month period will run whether you choose COBRA or not. COBRA has an 18-month benefit period. If you choose COBRA, do not wait until your COBRA ends in 18 months to enroll in Part B. The COBRA benefit period is longer than 8 months Medicare special enrollment period, and you may receive the famous Medicare Part B penalty, which goes all the way back to when you enrolled in Medicare Part A. Robert, you did everything correctly to enroll in Medicare Part B by contacting Social Security and faxing the CMS-L564 form requesting for employment information signed by your company HR department and CMS-40B form application for Part B. Fortunately, at least you were still within the correct time limits for your Medicare Part B to begin May 1st. You are in a Medicare glitch and the COBRA health plan is using coordination of benefits as their ruling. Chapter 1 of Tony's Medicare Survival Guide Advanced Edition explains various ways of enrolling in Medicare in detail. Visit TonySays.com for Medicare information. Group health insurance plans are state-regulated, not a Medicare-regulated plan. Since you're past 65 and already enrolled in Medicare Part A, the health plan is passing the 80% of the doctor medical bills on to Part B to Medicare. You were not enrolled in Medicare Part B from March 1st to April 30th, so Medicare is to pick up the difference. A bit of good news is that COBRA plans are credibly prescription drug coverage plans, and you are eligible for a special enrollment period of 63 days to enroll in Medicare Part D without receiving a Part D penalty. Please enroll your Part D prescription drug plan ASAP.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness for Wednesday, May 24th, 2023. Global Credential, MMH Achieves Pathway to Excellence Designation. Midland Health, designation for its commitment to a positive practice environment, culture of sustained excellence. Midland Memorial Hospital joins a premier group of organizations that have received Pathway to Excellence Designation from the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC. The Pathway designation is a global credential that highlights MMH's commitment to creating a healthy work environment where nurses feel empowered and valued. Midland Memorial Hospital's nurses are an integral part of the healthcare team with a voice in policy and practice. Pathway nurses are engaged, resulting in higher job satisfaction, reduced turnover, improved safety, and better patient outcomes. As a Pathway organization, MMH leads the effort to enhance quality of care, patient and nursing safety, and the future of healthcare delivery. Quote, the continued education to maintain a high-level work environment partnered with quality patient outcomes is proven through this designation and the history of achieving it for 12 years in a row, end quote, said Dr. Kit Bredemus, Chief Nursing Officer / Vice President of Nursing. Quote, Pathway to Excellence is one more way we are leading healthcare for Greater Midland, end quote. For more information on the Pathway to Excellence Recognition Program, visit ANCC's website at https://www.nursingworld.org/pathway. Other highlights, 42 Pathway organizations in Texas, only 192 in the world, only 17 with four or more designations, only one in the Permian Basin, Midland Memorial Hospital. Volunteer Program. MMH accepting applications for junior volunteers. Midland Memorial Hospital Auxiliary is accepting application for the Junior Volunteer Program, Summer Session 1, May/June, and Summer Session 2, July/August. The summer program is for youth aged 14 to 17 years old. The areas of service will include the information desk and popcorn services. Some of the duties at the information desk include taking hospital patients and family members to their destinations within the hospital. Popcorn duties include popping and selling popcorn. There is a uniform cost of $30. For more information, please contact Jackie Gieling at jaclynn.geiling@midlandhealth.org or 432-221-1542. Better Future. transforming lives of homeless families. Family Promise announces continued partnership with MW Builders. Family Promise of Midland, a leading organization dedicated to transforming the lives of families experiencing homelessness, announced this week its continued partnership with MW Builders, a nationally respected company with strong core values of supporting the community and nonprofits with their time, talent, and financial resources. As part of its commitment to providing essential assistance, MW Builders will embark on a pro bono initiative to renovate two outdated kitchens in duplexes belonging to Family Promise of Midland. The transformation will involve the installation of new countertops, backsplash, fixtures, plumbing, and appliances. Executive Director of Family Promise of Midland, Tom Miller, said in a news release, quote, through this remodel, MW Builders is bringing new life back into an old duplex, just like Family Promise brings new life to families, end quote. Fatal falls. Over 36,000 older people in the U.S. died in falls in 2020. In 2020, the deaths of 36,508 U.S. residents, 65 and older, were related to falls, representing 86% of all fatal falls that year, according to research published in the journal JAMA. Based on death certificate data compiled by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the research found that fatal falls in this age group had increased from 10,097 in 1999 and at a rate that more than doubled in about two decades, from 29 deaths per 100,000 people to 69 deaths per 100,000 people. The research notes that falls have become the leading cause of injury for the age group. More than one in four people 65 or older fall each year, according to the CDC, although the agency says less than half tell their doctor. About one in five falls results in a serious injury, such as broken bones or a head injury, and 3 million older adults are treated in emergency rooms each year because of falls. The report did not delineate what caused the falls included in its data, but health experts generally point to such potential fall causes as failing eyesight or hearing, problems with balance and gait, medications that can spark dizziness or confusion, high or low blood pressure, and more. Addressing issues. They say preventing falls starts with addressing such issues, getting vision checked and having a doctor review one's medications, including over-the-counter ones, to avoid medication-induced problems, for instance. But prevention also should include staying physically active, doing exercise that can improve balance and strength, and fall-proofing one's home by removing tripping hazards, such as throw rugs, upgrading lighting, and adding grab bars in the bathroom. 8 tips for parents, teens on social media use from Surgeon General. The U.S. Surgeon General is calling for tech companies and lawmakers to take, quote, immediate action, end quote, to protect kids and adolescents' mental health on social media. But after years of insufficient action by both social media platforms and policymakers, parents and young people still bear most of the burden in navigating the fast-changing, often harmful world of secretive algorithms, addictive apps, and extreme and inappropriate content found on platforms such as Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat. So what can parents and young people do now? Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has some tips. Quote, our children and adolescents don't have the luxury of waiting years until we know the full extent of social media's impact, end quote, Murthy said in an advisory released Tuesday. Quote, their childhoods and development are happening now, end quote. Tips for young people. Reach out for help. If you or someone you know is being negatively affected by social media, reach out to a trusted friend or adult for help. Check the American Academy of Pediatrics guidance on social media. Create boundaries. Limit the use of phones, tablets, and computers for at least 1 hour before bedtime and through the night to make sure you get enough sleep. Keep mealtimes and in-person gatherings device-free to help build social bonds and engage in two-way conversations with others. Connect with people in person and make unplugged interactions a daily priority. Be cautious about what you share. Personal information about you has value. Be selective with what you post and share online and with whom, as it is often public and can be stored permanently. If you aren't sure if you should post something, it's usually best if you don't. Don't keep harassment or abuse a secret. Reach out to at least one person you trust, such as a close friend, family member, counselor, or teacher who can give you the help and support you deserve. Visit stopbullying.gov for tips on how to report cyberbullying. If you have experienced online harassment and abuse by a dating partner, contact an expert at Love is Respect for support. If your private images have been taken and shared online without your permission, visit Take It Down to help get them removed. Tips for parents, caregivers. Create a family media plan. Agreed upon expectations can help establish healthy technology boundaries at home, including social media use. A family media plan can promote open family discussion and rules about media use and include topics such as balancing screen/online time, content boundaries, and not disclosing personal information. Create tech-free zones. Restrict the use of electronics at least 1 hour before bedtime and through the night. Keep mealtimes and other in-person gatherings tech-free. Help children develop social skills and nurture their in-person relationships by encouraging unstructured and offline connections with others. Model responsible behavior. Parents can set a good example of what responsible and healthy social media use looks like by limiting their own use. Being mindful of social media habits, including when and how parents share information or content about their child, and modeling positive behavior on your social media accounts. Empower kids. Teach kids about technology and empower them to be responsible online participants at the appropriate age. Discuss with children the benefits and risks of social media, as well as the importance of respecting privacy and protecting personal information in age-appropriate ways. Have conversations with children about who they are connecting with, their privacy settings, their online experiences, and how they are spending their time online. How much screen time is too much time for your kids? How much screen time is too much for a child? Reports of teens facing high rates of depression, anxiety, and loneliness have led to recommendations about their use of social media. Dr. Nisheen Aminuddin is a Mayo Clinic pediatrician and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. While there are many benefits to technology, she says it also can affect children and teens in negative ways, including some behavioral changes. Is your teen always texting or gaming, or you just don't know? Quote, we've always told parents to try to monitor their children's online content, to try to limit it, to make sure that it's not affecting their sleep or their schoolwork or their mood, end quote, says Dr. Aminuddin. And she says that's a huge job. Kids can get online literally from the palms of their hands. Quote, for parents, I would recommend that they check in with their kid and try to find out what kids are doing when they're online, end quote, she says. Quote, are they spending time playing games with friends, or are they searching for things? Are they using it for schoolwork? End quote. Excessive use of social media can be related to how it affects your child, she says. Quote, anything that is affecting your child's sleep, anything that's affecting their mood, anything that is affecting their academic performance would be considered excessive use, end quote, says Dr. Aminuddin. She says that parents and adult caregivers know their children best and are likely in the best position to know what is or isn't excessive. If you are concerned, she says, talk with your child's pediatrician or healthcare team for advice. Screen time tips. Screen time can refer to time spent on smartphones, tablets, TVs, or gaming devices. That could mean texting friends, watching videos or movies, playing games, doing homework, and browsing the internet. Here are some ways to help establish healthy screen time habits. Communicate. Talk openly with your children about the video games and content they engage with online. Set, quote, no screen, end quote, times. Designate periods without screens, like mealtime and 1 hour before bed. Bedroom charging. Encourage charging devices outside the bedroom for better sleep. Lead by example. Demonstrate healthy screen habits such as putting your phone on, quote, do not disturb, end quote, during family time and during dinner.
Here is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, May 25th. Aging man's antics and ego make him hard to be around. Dear Abby, my narcissistic father feels entitled to do whatever he pleases. He has always insisted that since he makes the money, far more than my mother's income, he should be waited on and cleaned up after. If he stays in my home, he leaves messes everywhere. He's 70, but he acts like a 4-year-old. He loves attention and will do anything to be the center of it, whether it's wearing a kilt or showing off his intellectual prowess. I have no relationship with him, and I'm okay with that. Mom complains constantly about him, and then defends him. It's emotionally exhausting. My husband, our kids, and I are appalled at his lack of self-awareness, empathy, or caring. He makes going on vacation a nightmare. He feels that if he does all the driving, then he's done his part and refuses to help with anything else. He is difficult and manipulative. He's getting worse as he gets older, and I no longer want to subject my family to this. My mother doesn't seem to understand this. How do I deal with a narcissistic father and a mother who refuses to acknowledge it and constantly makes excuses for him? Signed, Exasperated in Pennsylvania. Dear Exasperated, one way to deal with it would be to stop taking vacations with them, since the vacations seem to be anything but pleasant for you and your family. Try to avoid him as often as you can. When your mother complains about Dad, point out that this is the prize she married and you are tired of hearing her complain since she won't assert herself. Then change the subject when she brings it up. Dear Abby, my brother is emerging from a painful 2-year-long divorce, during which his 2 teenage daughters and 1 grown daughter became estranged from him. His now ex-wife overshared with them during the divorce and did everything she could to prevent them from seeing him, despite court orders for him to have joint custody, visitation, and therapy. My brother isn't perfect, but he loves his girls and wants them in his life. He's slowly making progress with one of his minor daughters. My problem is his ex has caused them to shun the rest of their paternal relatives. My 2 sisters, their aunts, and I are pained by the loss of those relationships. We still reach out at holidays and birthdays with texts, gifts, and well wishes, but we receive no response, not even a polite thank you. Because we stood by our brother during a terrible experience, we are guilty by association. Should we continue reaching out or leave them alone until they are ready to have a relationship with us again? Signed, Victim of Divorce. Dear Victim, I don't think you should continue sending gifts that go unacknowledged. However, leave the lines of communication open by sending cards to your nieces on appropriate occasions. If you haven't discussed this with your brother, I recommend you do, and take your lead from him.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.